arrested shackled and often without being informed of the reasons for their detention or granted access to legal counsel. Also, testimonies from released prisoners describe repeated beatings, stress positions, electric shocks, the use of dogs during interrogations, and forced nudity or other forms of degrading treatment. Many detainees return to their families or to medical examiners with signs of severe beatings, starvation, and untreated medical conditions.
They use tear gas against us every week. It's difficult to describe the pain we suffered in the prison. The men were constantly being beaten.
We weren't allowed to sleep. They forced us to stay awake for 16 hours. The food is terrible. You need permission to go to the toilet. They forbid us from praying.
Local NGOs say nearly 100 Palestinians have died in Israeli prisons or detention centers since 2 years ago. The real number is believed to be far higher due to a lack of transparency, missing detainees, and Israeli regime's refusal to release full information. UN experts have repeatedly raised the alarm over arbitrary detentions and widespread mistreatment of prisoners. They have demanded Israel immediately end the systematic torture and abuse of Palestinian detainees to protect their rights to life and to allow independent oversight.
There continue to be the use of practices that clearly violate the prohibition on torture and other cruel, inhuman or degrading treatments, such as constant blindfolding, stress positions, handcuffing for extended periods of time, overcrowding, degrading conditions.
Israeli officials have denied access to independent monitors and have failed to comply with court orders demanding improved food, hygiene, and medical care inside detention facilities. Global human rights organizations warn without an independent international investigation and full detainee information, prisoners and their families will continue to be denied justice and more detainees will remain at risk.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Mohammed Al-Ghiq, political analyst, writer and former Palestinian prisoner, joining us from Ramallah. And Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief from MENA Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. Well, it is indeed a pleasure to have my guest with me. It is a very important topic and I'm going to start. Let me see which one of my guests is available right now. Mohammed Al-Ghiq is with me right now. Mohammed, I'm going to start the conversation with you. First, I want to talk about the legal and more specifically the international law perspective. These administrative detentions, how do they align with or contradict international legal standards?
Yeah, thank you for having me. First and foremost, Israel ignored the international community, ignored the international law. And by the way, it uses the administrative detention as a tool to torture the Palestinians, to prevent them from their life, to distract their daily life, their future, under the pretext of secret information or files to prevent them from resistance, etc. I think the recent actions from the Israeli prison service and the Israeli army, the Israeli government, indicate the systematic, the organized policies against the Palestinians, the Palestinian prisoners, their life. The Palestinian prisoners, by the way, have been subjected to torture, isolation, medical negligence. All of these types of restrictions or collective punishment, as you like to name, all these policies, I think, Israel took it because took them because the absence of the accountability, the absence of the real will of the international community, the international law, and the silence of the Arab countries, the Muslim countries, that encouraged Israel to take bolder steps against the Palestinian prisoners by starving them, isolating them, right, torturing them. This is the point here, and with these conditions, I think Israel will take more steps against them.
Mohammed, now that they are, you're assuming that these are like contrary to the international law, what I want you to tell me, can these actions be also classified as war crimes or crimes against humanity?
This is an important question. Thank you for this question. We are here. Let's look at a bigger picture now. We saw the measures of ICJ and ICC against Netanyahu, Yoav Gallant, and some officials in Israel, but we didn't see any action from ICJ, at least, against the head of the Israeli prison service. She has to be held accountable here, and we didn't see any actions. That means the pressure from the U.S. on the ICJ and ICC, even the United Nations, is huge to prevent them from take any points or any steps against Israel. Now, with this situation, okay, Israel will go ahead against the Palestinians. By the way, they are preparing for execution bill against the Palestinian prisoners to achieve many goals here. And why they wanted that?
Right.
Because they paralyzed will of the international community.
Indeed, very insightful. Thank you so much, Mohammed. Well, gladly, Leila Hatoum is also with us right now. Leila is editor-in-chief of MENA Uncensored. Great to have you on this program. Leila, we're talking about the legal perspective on the issue of abuses that are happening and occurring and reoccurring in Israeli jails. Now that we can consider them, if we can consider them like crimes against humanity and war crimes, what will be the role of the International Criminal Court now?
Most definitely not only crimes against humanity, but war crimes as well. You have to understand, under international law, Israel is considered an occupation power. That's why the United Nations calls the West Bank the occupied Palestinian territories. In that sense, the occupation has duties and obligations. One of them is not to persecute or ethnically cleanse the land, or basically do arbitrary detention and torturing people. So at the end of the day, because of the state of war between the Palestinians and the Israeli occupation, because of the state of the occupation under international law, this is considered not only a crime against humanity, but also a war crime. Needless to say that every war crime is a crime against humanity in that sense. Detaining people without basically arbitrary detention, without any basically cause, at the same time torture, sexual assault, raping, among other things, electrocution, constant blindfolding, all of those constitute crimes. However, you have to bring them to the court of justice, be it the ICJ through countries, like basically South Africa did to the genocide that's happening in Gaza, or basically to the ICC against certain individuals to be able to prosecute the Israelis over that matter. Unfortunately, until today, we did not see neither the Palestinian Authority nor the states actually bringing these cases to the ICJ. They only brought the cases that were happening in Gaza, the constant genocide over there, to actually go after the Israeli occupation and its officers and its basically officials as well. So in the next phase, we need to see states and what you call larger entities, like Human Rights Watch, among others, moving such cases at the ICC level. So no matter what, we need to have cases to be able to prosecute the Israelis. However, I do understand that the ICC and the ICJ are paper tigers. They're toothless. They have no ability to implement their decisions. So in that sense, you have to have the victims or their families file individual lawsuits or class action lawsuits,
right,
against Israeli officials who are directly tied to such crimes like Ben-Gvir, among others, in different countries across the world.
Right, Mohammed. Well, of course, you're a former prisoner. You've experienced and been through the Israeli prison life. I want you to tell me, to what extent do you believe policies like this administrative detention are rooted in security concerns rather than political directives?
Your guest, Leila, said, the international community, the international law, put Israel and encouraged Israel to go through these policies, like the administrative detention. Okay, When they arrested me, for example, when they arrested me, they accused me with or of many charges, like military actions, etc. I refused these charges. They threatened me to go through the administrative detention or to admit these charges. I refused, and they changed me. And they turned me to administrative detention. I began my hunger strike against that. Why they use this policy, the administrative detention, to achieve many goals, to prevent the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank, and to vanish or to destroy the spiritual soul of the Palestinians, especially the prisoners inside jails, to intimidate the Palestinian people, the internal front, and to deter the leaders of the resistance in the West Bank, or influencers, writers, academic staffs, students, all these sectors, Israel considered them as a terrorism or as a threat against its existence. This is the policy of Israel against the Palestinians in the West Bank under many pretexts. Now they use the same policy against the Palestinians from Gaza, from West Bank, Jerusalem. Why? To achieve these goals, to deter the Palestinians. I think with the silence of the international community, Israel considers itself above the international law. And by the way, it took bolder steps against the Palestinians, to torture them, to isolate them. By the way, we saw the two recent stories in one day, just in one day. The story of Tasnim and Hams from Gaza and her conditions reflect the situation inside Israel, the reality there. And the second story from Jenin. After they arrested two people there, they shoot them, they killed them. Why? This is the law of as jungle land. They use these policies against the Palestinians because the absence of the accountability.
Right. Leila, I wanted to talk to you about the effect of this aggressive and inhumane, one must say, prisoner policies in Israel and how it affects the broader Israeli-Palestine conflict.
Well, you have to understand that the Israelis are not there to actually create peace between them and the Palestinians or any of their neighbors. In that sense, they have to create an atmosphere of animosity around them. And how do they do that? By targeting every generation. It's very rare to find a single Palestinian, be it a child, a teenager, or a man, who hasn't served, even a woman, by the way, who haven't served some time in the Israeli concentration camps. These are not prisons. Again, this is an occupation. So these are concentration camps. Most of them have basically suffered under arbitrary detention and administrative detention, as we call it, which is detaining people without cause for lengthy periods of time. So at the end of the day, they are creating that atmosphere of animosity around them to create that friction and to tell the world, look at us. We are trying to find peace over here, but the people around us hate peace and they keep attacking us, so we have to eliminate them. The way that it reflects on the Palestinian society and the relations between the Israelis and the Palestinians, there will always be vendetta. I mean, if they haven't killed somebody from a Palestinian family, they have surely detained one and tortured one, and they have taken loved ones away from their families. In that sense, they will continue to disrupt the fabric within the Palestinian society, and they will continue to create that friction. And eventually, basically, we saw what happened. Tension in Gaza, tension in the West Bank. Today, they have basically cleaned the Palestinian refugee camps of nearly 56,000 Palestinians. They are not allowed to go back to their basically camps in the West Bank, right? And they have detained most of them, including one of the mayors from Tamun. So when you look at the whole situation, the Israelis are looking to create that friction so they can use it as an excuse to continue to take further land and attack the Palestinians. The Palestinians will feel left out by the international community, as usual, and they will have to take matters into their own hands, and then they will be blamed for it, and they will be called terrorists. It will be always that broken record of the Israelis creating a problem, the Palestinians retaliating to it, then the Palestinians will be blamed for the fact that they are actually retaliating.
Right, Mohammed, if you remember a few weeks ago, when the video of the Israeli abuse in prison was leaked by a high-ranked military official of Israel, we were discussing this, and you said this is not just to inform others, this is to instill fears, and this is a propaganda step by the Israeli regime. It's well thought of. I want to talk about the Israeli domestic politics. How do you think they affect such prisoner policies?
I think Israel implements the carrot and stick policy against the Palestinians, and measures, and desperate times, desperate measures. They don't care about the humanity. They don't care about human laws or humanitarian coordination or something else, or even the humanitarian protocol. They violated the international law. They violated all the international laws, most notably the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. But I will be precise here. The Israeli government intensified these policies against the Palestinians to achieve the main goal for them, the nucleus goal, to expand it, its territories, and to put more pressure on the Palestinians, especially in the West Bank. When you see the daily life in the West Bank, you will be surprised. Checkpoints, military barriers, iron gates, demolishing homes, confiscating land, and they intensified the settlers' attacks against the Palestinian properties, main roads, water springs, pastoral areas, etc. Why Israel implemented these policies? To annex the West Bank, to cram people into the hard cities, and to deter the Palestinians, to prevent the resistance, and to send a message to the neighboring countries that Israel has a plan, and it coordinated its plan with Trump to go through the new Middle East project, to go through Greater Israel at the expense of the Palestinians, at the expense of the neighboring countries, at the expense of the stability and prosperity in the region. This is the point for Israel, because of that they use these policies against prisoners, against people, against civilians in the West Bank and Gaza, even in Jerusalem.
Right, Leila, I want to not talk about the international reactions to these allegations. Ethically speaking, what is the responsibility of the global communities and also the NGOs, both in recording these abuses and responding to them?
Well, you have to understand that most of the international community, including the big five countries at one point in time, have signed or ratified or joined almost all of the agreements when it comes to human rights, when it comes to stopping a genocide, when it comes to upholding their role in the international community to stop crimes against humanity. So at the end of the day, when you look at the situation where some of the countries show that they are shocked, but they don't do any action, others disregard it completely, playing dumb, basically deaf and blind, it tells you a lot that almost all of the international community is complicit on this in this matter. Otherwise, the Israelis wouldn't have been flying above the radar and above international law. They have impunity because of this lack of action, the inaction of the international community. We have 192 member states of the United Nations and one entity, which is the occupation entity. And the 192, you only have about 191 who actually didn't take any action, and only one took an action. That's basically Iran. We have to be very, very clear about this. The only state that took action as a state is Iran. The rest of the states, they didn't do anything. Sending few packages of food over here and there, throwing some money to the on the problem, it doesn't change anything. Boycott should have been played on a wider scale. It didn't. And that's the least that they could have done. They kept the Israeli entity as a member, quasi-member of the United Nations. The United Nations didn't kick them out or suspend them. And that's very interesting to see. And then you have the big five countries protecting the Israeli entity. So at the end of the day, I'm looking at complicity, hypocrisy, and the will not to do any action. This is by will. This is actually something that they chose to do.
Regarding this willingness, Mohammed, I want to see, what do you think about the Israeli response to all the UN resolutions, some international calls that exist in order to end these alleged abuses of the Palestinian detainees? What does it say about Israel's willingness to engage with global accountability mechanisms?
Unfortunately, let me clarify something for you. The recent decision from the Security Council about Gaza vanished all the resolutions, all the decisions to give the Palestinians their rights. And by the way, the recent decision gave Israel more self-confidence, gave Israel more a huge permission to go through the accession plan, to go through its policies against the Palestinians. And when we are talking about the international community, the complicity, the silence of the Arab regimes, we are talking about the massacres of Israel and border steps on the ground. Now, what is the point of United Nations Charter if it doesn't stop the starvation, the genocide, the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, the organized policies against the Palestinian prisoners, at least to give the Palestinians their right? We heard many stories from the Israeli jails, not to mention Sidi Man, rape crimes, etc. Something about the Palestinian prisoners. We are talking about the reality now. Israel wanted to change the reality in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Jerusalem, and the neighboring countries to implement its plan. And we have to see the actions from the international community. Now, we have nothing. All these efforts will be in vain because there is no accountability now.
Right.
Let me tell you about the prisoners. We didn't hear or we didn't see any statement from the international community of the Red Cross about the Palestinian prisoners and the subjugation and the policies against them. But we are hearing many statements. We are seeing many stances from the international community, from the international institutions about the Israeli prisoners, and they asked, they demanded to bring them back home. But about the Palestinian prisoners, nothing. This is the double standards policy.
Right. It was a pleasure to have you both on this show. Thank you so much, Mohammed Al-Ghig, political analyst, writer, and former Palestinian prisoner joining us from Ramallah, and also Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief of MENA Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. So this was another Spotlight. Thank you so much for staying with us.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For
humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum. This is Hussein, and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about Islamic teachings and Quranic concepts related to humanity. And in the couple of previous episodes, we started covering a very good book in this regard titled A 250-Year-Old Person, which is a combination of the lectures delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, which covers the biographies and the seerah, the lifestyle, and the lessons from the life of the Prophet of Islam Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and the great leaders of Muslim community from among his pure progeny. By covering these elements and these stories, we learn more about the virtues and personal elements, personality elements that are a standard and that are valuable according to Islamic teachings. In the previous episodes, we talked about different challenges that the Prophet had in establishing and building a Muslim community from zero. He started building Muslim community from zero from Mecca and continued this in Medina as well and later on. So one challenge was the pagans of Mecca, big challenge. Also, there was the challenge that the Prophet had with the Jewish communities of Medina, the betrayal and treason that these people displayed time and again against the Prophet. In back doors, they were trying to make alliance with the pagans in order to attack the Prophet, especially in the Battle of the Trench, the greatest example of treason at the time of war. And then after finishing that problem or that challenge, then we should also discuss about the other challenge that the Prophet had, and it was the challenge by or of hypocrites, munafiqun. Now, the concept of hypocrisy or nifaq in Islam and Quranic teachings is a very important concept. Like, after there you have kufr, which is disbelief, and then you have nifaq. According to some of the verses of the Holy Quran, that munafiqun are even lower than kuffar, infidels. Now, this is important to consider, that according to Islamic teaching, sometimes if a person shows something that does not believe, okay, this is called nifaq. That such a person is lower than a person who honestly says or displays whatever that he believes or rejects. So nifaq in Arabic means a person who has kept for himself two ways always. It comes from nafaq, channel or canal. So it means that a person always preserves a way for him to come back. Like, for example, some people, when they joined the Muslim community, some of them even, you can say they did not join it, sincerely. They just saw themselves or found themselves caught up in the situation. So they displayed iman, according to the Holy Quran. Some of them would say that we bear witness. قَالُوا نَشْهَدُ إِنَّكَ لَرَسُولُ اللَّهِ. We bear witness that you are the Prophet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وَاللَّهُ يَشْهَدُ إِنَّهُمْ لَكَاذِبُونَ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bears witness that they are liars. So they would lie because the advantages of the iman and Islam, they wanted to have the advantages, but they did not want to sacrifice anything for Islam. Always looking for some time, for some opportunities to take advantage from this community, but never ready to sacrifice anything. This is the definition of nifaq. So these people, they were not few in Medina. Some of them, relatively speaking, and they pose challenges to the Muslim community in Medina. Inshallah, we're going to cover and continue the discussion after a short break. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa.
فاطمة الزهراء
Welcome back. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the challenge posed by Munafiqun, hypocrites in Medina, to the Prophet ﷺ and to Muslim community. And some of these people were very smart in concealing their true colors, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Quran says, لا تعلمهم نحن نعلمهم. There are some of these munafiqun that you do not know them, we know them. And they were very smart, very complicated, very sophisticated. Because some of the munafiqun, everybody knew that they are munafiq. They're hypocrite, okay? It happens also in politics. And when it comes to sociopolitical issues, context, people realize that this person does not have any good reputation in this regard. He is an opportunist just trying to secure his own position. So everybody knows that, almost everyone. But then for some people, or with some people, no, it gets more complicated. And that's why Quran says, لَا تَعْلَمُهُمْ نَحْنُ نَعْلَمُهُمْ. This level of nifaq, it's even hidden from you. So naturally, this is the natural level of the Prophet's knowledge, because we believe that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has granted to the Prophet knowledge of the unseen, but the Prophet ﷺ would not use that knowledge always. So Alm al-Ghaib was there, but it was not used always by the Prophet. Sometimes if he wanted, if he wished, he could have access to it. But normally he would not use Alm al-Ghaib here and there. So Quran says, when he says, La ta'lamuhum, you do not know them, he talks about the natural, normal level of knowledge. Anyways, so munafiqun, there is this great distinction between different kinds of people, different types of munafiq, hypocrites. As long as it was a personal issue, personal hatred, personal evil intentions, anything, the Prophet did not have any problem with them. Actually, he would embarrass them. He would humble them with his great akhlaq. Now, all other companions would tell the Prophet, okay, why are you not encountering these munafiqs in the way that they encounter you, like impolite and rude? The Prophet would say, no, they are part of my community. And there is this hadith that the Prophet said, I do not like that people say that Muhammad put sword among his own companions. So maybe because of their reputation, or because of the fact that they would not pose a challenging threat to the community, the Prophet ﷺ would not encounter them the way that they encountered the Prophet, and would most of the time humble them and embarrass them with his great akhlaq and manners. But then, if the hypocrites wanted to have an organized campaign, now there was a time that the Prophet would take action, would take measures to stop them, serious measures and immediate. That's very important. So not all people who are hypocrites are in the same boat. Some of them, they are like individual problems, personal problems they have. And that is true in Islamic societies as well. If a person has a personal problem, let him do whatever he wants, okay? But then if they are having an organized campaign, whether this campaign is a political campaign or a cultural campaign or anything, that they want to make a change in Islamic society, as a leader, you cannot just watch them do what they want to do, okay? You cannot watch them that they bring corruption to Muslim society. So this distinction is very valuable. We're going to talk about it, inshallah, in the next episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever.
Tonight, a tiny angel sleeps on my knees. She's only 5 years old, but her heart's bigger than the seas. Tonight, our house is filled with the sound of the angel's wings.
She has so many more friends in the skies than on the earth. Oh, my daughter, you're my sword. You're my calm in the storm. All my dreams will come true 'cause of you. You are a part of me and the light of my eyes. It's you. But longing for heaven, I breathe in your scent anew. You're a part of me and the light of my eyes. It's you. But longing for heaven, I breathe in your scent anew. You shine like the moon and the stars revolve around you. You dream of a holy sun rising and this dead world starting to bloom. Oh, my daughter, you're my sword. You're my calm in the storm. All my dreams will come true 'cause of you. You are a part of me and the light of my eyes. It's you, the longing for heaven. On the earth, hard and unique. I close my eyes, praying for you, and softly kiss your cheek. You are the color of me and the light of my eyes. It's you.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
In a dramatic shift, the Trump administration has slashed crucial HIV/AIDS funding for Africa, risking millions of lives. Now, as billions of dollars in U.S. military assistance flow to the genocidal Israeli regime, why is Africa's health being sacrificed? Will the continent fight back and build its own future, or is it too late? Now, to help us unpack the move by Trump to cut HIV/AIDS funding for Africa, we are joined by two distinguished guests. First, we have Tahrir Hassan. Now, he is an executive member of the International Solidarity Movement for Africa and Palestine. We are also joined by Prince Dr. Philip Njemanze. He is an esteemed academician and chairman of the Global Pro-Life Alliance. Stay with us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we delve deep into this issue. In a shocking shift of priorities, the Trump administration has drastically slashed U.S. foreign aid cutting HIV funding for Africa. USAID's 2024 budget for sub-Saharan Africa dropped significantly, affecting 25 million people in 2024. South Africa faces a loss of $427 million, putting over 500,000 lives at risk. Yet, despite these devastating cuts, the U.S. continues to funnel billions of dollars in military aid to the Israeli regime amid its ongoing genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. Since October 7, 2023, the U.S. has spent more than $22 billion supporting the Israeli regime's war crimes. Now, what's more, Trump's rush to exploit Africa's rich deposits of rare earth minerals shows his administration's eagerness to extract the continent's resources while turning a blind eye to the health and well-being of its people. So how can the Trump administration justify such drastic reductions to health programs while prioritizing support for genocide in Gaza and resource extraction in Africa? Is this a clear message that African lives don't matter as much as geopolitical and economic gain? With Africa's future hanging in the balance, will the continent rise to build self-sustaining health systems?
Trump cuts Africa aid, funds Gaza genocide.
The abrupt halt of the U.S. presence emergency plan for aid relief funding to South Africa threatens the country's fight against HIV, putting thousands of healthcare workers' jobs at risk and also disrupting treatment for millions of patients. However, South Africa's health minister says the move by President Trump is a much-needed wake-up call. Let's take a listen.
I want to regard this moment as a wake-up call, because whether we like it or not, it is the responsibility of every government to provide for its people. It's not the responsibility of other governments. I understand the issue of solidarity, but every government on this planet has got a responsibility to provide for its people. That's where it must start, which means there must be very clear political will. Because I agree with Mama Winnie here, that this type of relationship where we depend on one country, and when the country is in some negative mood, the whole world collapses. Yes, it's scary. In fact, I was asking myself, how did we arrive here, where all of us depends on one country?
The U.S. has slashed funding for combating HIV/AIDS epidemic in Africa, including significant cuts to South Africa's initiatives. While it is true Africans might have benefited from the funding, but there are always hidden benefits for the donors. Now, our first question goes to Fahriye Hassan. Now, in your opinion, what was the real reason behind U.S. funding the fight against HIV/AIDS in South Africa and other African countries?
Now, I have studied this quite intensely, and it turns out that much of this funding was designed in order to provide, I would say, it was mainly a United States foreign policy to give funding, but to impose certain directives on South Africa. You know, so while it did alleviate some of the epidemic and treatment on for people, the United States used to use this funding as leverage. I'll give you an example of this. So the Ministry of Health in South Africa would receive funding, but in order for them to receive the funding to treat the patients, they would have to provide the United States with, for instance, coal. They would have to provide them with certain raw materials. So it wasn't, as I would say, a straightforward, giving money to South Africa as a aid in terms of aid. It was with strings attached.
Now, for a long time, Africa relied heavily on U.S. foreign aid for health programs, especially for combating HIV/AIDS. Prince Dr. Philip Jemanze, this for you. What's your take on the move by the U.S. to cut its assistance for Africa?
Might be distressing to some people, especially those people living with HIV. But on a systemic outlook, when you look at it as an expert, it is actually a welcome development. Because in the first place, foreign governments should not be investing directly into the health sector. Because what they do is that they cause a distortion of the health sector. The United States chose HIV, but that's not our priority. If you look at the epidemiology, HIV is far more less than diarrheal diseases. We could have probably chosen to fund diarrheal diseases where the money can be now put in provision of potable water. This will provide real development. When you put that money in HIV, this will go to the pharmaceutical companies who are still coming from the United States and other countries. So it leaves no developmental impact in Africa.
The U.S. is cutting billions in foreign aid to Africa, especially in health sectors, while continuing to allocate large sums to military support for Israel, despite its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. Clearly, black lives don't matter for the U.S. and Israel.
First and foremost, in Africa, what is the role of Israel in Africa? And of course, the second part is, how does this impact on the genocide that Israel is perpetrating in Gaza at the moment? So what has happened is that Israel, as an entity, has imposed or as a foreign policy in Africa, whereby in conjunction with the Americans are obviously using the African command or AFRICOM in order to drive certain foreign policy directives. On the other hand, Israel has got a much more sinister need for their role in Africa. So what I'm trying to say is the role that Israel plays is a very nefarious role, in that they exploit and even use slave labor from Africa in order to impose their will in order to carry out. And of course, the fact that the Palestinians, the Gazans, are not going into Israel, it has a major impact on their economy, you know. And as a result, this is what they've done. They've recruited slave labor from Africa in order to carry out their genocide in Gaza.
Trump's policies seem to prioritize military alliances over humanitarian aid. Now, the U.S. is giving military assistance to the Israeli apartheid regime and many African countries, while cutting funding for critical health initiatives in Africa. Now, while the U.S. is cutting its health aid to Africa, its military aid is seen as a source of destabilization in the continent. Dr. Jemanze, do you agree with this?
We don't want the militarization of Africa. We don't want all the military games being played, AFRICOM and all the other ones coming up in the continent. Because all what they have done is to fuel internal violence in the country and cause mass distortions. You will see Boko Haram exploded, not because there were no Western presence. There is because there were a lot of Western military presence. So instead of violence to reduce, it actually increased.
Well, thanks for that. Let's take a short break before we continue our discussion on the move by the U.S. to cut its HIV/AIDS assistance to African countries. Stay with us.
Trump cuts Africa aid, funds Gaza genocide.
Former President of Kenya Uhuru Kenyatta criticized African leaders who panicked over Trump's decision to halt foreign aid. Speaking at a health conference, Mr. Kenyatta said Africa should think of how to judicially use its available resources rather than relying on foreign assistance.
This is a wake-up call for you to say, okay, what are we going to do to help ourselves? Instead of crying, tujiulize, what are we going to do? Haya, ametoa hiyo pesa, sasa tutafanya namna gani jameni? What are we going to do? Yeah? To support ourselves.
Now, in light of the U.S. aid cuts, some leaders like we have seen Uhuru Kenyatta have argued that Africa should take greater responsibility for funding its own health programs, citing tax evasion and the looting of African resources by the same Western countries that provide the so-called aid to Africa. Now, Mr. Hassan, do you see these as an opportunity for Africa to move away from dependency on foreign aid and develop a more self-sufficient healthcare system?
I would like to bring in somebody by the name of Ibrahim Traore of Burkina Faso. I think what he's doing in his country has demonstrated that, yes, that Africa can indeed stand on its own feet. And why am I using Burkina Faso as an example? Because one of the things that had plagued the African continent and various countries has been terrorism. It has now come to light, given the Department of Government Efficiency run by Elon Musk, revelations about the role of U.S. aid in Africa, and that much of that aid has been going to terrorists, you know, so funding of Boko Haram, funding of Al-Qaeda, and so on. What Ibrahim Traore has done, he was able to use his power as the president of the country in order to rid the country of much of the terrorists. What then happened was, as they pushed out the French and the terror groupings, they were able to take over much of the mining industry, the gold and uranium and platinum mining industry, and so on. And with the result that now, that funding is now coming into the fiscus of the government. And Ibrahim Traore has shown, I mean, he's built something like 50 or 60 schools, new schools. He's built many hospitals, road infrastructure. He's built ports, you know, his road infrastructure, his bridges, and so on, etc., giving people access to more. He's upgraded the agriculture and so on. So this is clear evidence that if Africa can rid itself from Western domination and the colonialist past, and of course now it's out in the open that it was the West that has been funding these terrorists, Africa would be able to become very prosperous if they are able to use their own resources.
South Africa's government has vowed not to let the U.S.'s withdrawal of $427 million in HIV/AIDS support collapse its programs, which are among the largest in the world. Experts say that other African countries should follow suit in building more sustainable, self-reliant health systems in response to foreign aid reductions.
The actions by the South African government was in the interest of the South of South Africa. And the Nigerian government, after the withdrawal of the aid, took up the responsibility of providing drugs and the necessary things to people living with HIV/AIDS. These are welcome. That's the way it should be from the beginning. So African countries, we want to get the prevailing atmosphere in Africa is we don't need this aid. Don't give us any aid. Come, we want fair trade, and we will trade with anyone. You can't dictate to us whether we will trade with this country or that country. No, we want fair deal. If it's gold you are interested in, there is a market price. It's a fair market price. Buy it at that. You can't buy it at 80 cents and sell it at 200 euros. And then tell us that you turn around and give us 10 billion in aid. We could have gotten that money ourselves from the minerals, far more, maybe 20 times more. So we don't, this whole attitude that Africa is a continent that has to be helped with aid is just nonsense, and we don't want any of it again.
While Trump met African leaders amid plans to extract critical minerals from the continent, he simultaneously slashed U.S. aid assistance for African health programs. Dr. Jemanze, how do you interpret this contradiction that while Trump is eager to tap into Africa's mineral wealth, he seems indifferent to the lives of Africans, as evidenced by the deep cuts to life-saving aid like HIV support?
Well, once it comes to the actions of President Trump, he, I think, is guided by the best interest of the United States, as far as they see it. And we should be guided by our own best interest. As I have said before, we do not need Western or any other person's aid. What we need is fair trade. If he's negotiating with African presidents and say, okay, we're interested in your minerals, not to come here for extraction, we want to buy it at the international market, fine. We are open for business. We tell you the price. The price is the international price, market price. You pay for it and you take it. So, and that should be our attitude.
Well, there you have it. For Africa to develop and cut aid dependency, it should benefit from its own minerals and should not let countries such as the U.S. continue looting the continent's resources. I'd like to thank our guests today, Mr. Fahri Hassan and Prince Dr. Philip Njemanze, for their incisive analysis.
Hello, I am Jannat Ali, and welcome to a new series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Carthage civilization. Founded by the Phoenician settlers from around Tyre, 814 BCE, Carthage was located in present-day Tunisia. The city's strategic location on the Mediterranean coast facilitated trade and naval dominance, making it one of the wealthiest cities in the ancient world by the 4th century BCE. Carthage controlled territories across North Africa, southern Iberia, and several Mediterranean islands. Carthage's rise to power was marked by its maritime capabilities, extensive trade networks, and a formidable navy. The city's economy thrived on trading goods such as gold, silver, ivory, and textile. Carthage also developed a complex political system with a powerful ruling elite and a strong military composed of mercenaries from various regions. However, Carthage's prosperity eventually led to the conflict with the Roman Republic. The two powers clashed in a series of wars known as the Punic Wars between 264 and 146 BCE. Despite the famous exploits of General Hannibal, Carthage ultimately lost to Rome. The Third Punic War between 149 and 146 BCE ended with the complete destruction of the Carthage by the Romans. The city was razed and the territory annexed. The Romans later rebuilt Carthage, making it an important center of the Roman Empire. Today, the ruins of Carthage are a UNESCO World Heritage Site, preserving the remnants of this once great civilization. Notable structures include the Birisa Hill, the Antonine Baths, and the Punic Port, all maintained as part of the Carthage National Archaeological Park. That was a brief description of the Carthage civilization. From me, Janet Ali, it's goodbye for now.
And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.